and welcome to the local news roundup on The Point. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran. We're going to be discussing some of the top local news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Chris Lindahl is here from the Cape Cod Times. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Sean.
Thanks for coming into the Woods Hole studio. Appreciate it. And also joining me in the studio is George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, George.
Good morning, Sean.
Would you miss a ferry or something? What happened?
No. Happy to be here.
I appreciate you being here as well. And we'll also speak with Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim DeRuiter of the New Bedford Standard Times, Ed Miller of the Provincetown Banner. And as I said, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, we've got lots to talk about. Let's start with the NRC. That's the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They pay attention to what's happening at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. And there's always a lot happening at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. But they issued a pretty large, hefty report, Chris Lindahl, and they've found some low-risk violations and some other things they're talking about in that report.
Yeah, so this was a 200-page report that was released on Wednesday, and it's outlining some of the things that they found in their three-phase special inspection last year, the most notable of which was a failure to properly maintain an emergency diesel generator, and that's used to cool it's used to power the cooling system that turns on in the event of power loss in the area.
It's like a backup system.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, so now the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is still determining how egregious this violation is. And so the station is reviewing the report, and they're going to determine their own next course of action.
Next course of action, right. We were waiting for this report. I think there had been some preliminary discussion about it. This is the result of a team of inspectors from the NRC who descended on Pilgrim to take a look at everything. And actually, what came out of that was a memo that was leaked to the Cape Cod Times that talked about some problems there. And that led to a public meeting. So it's been a long kind of road to get to this point where we have the report in hand.
That's right. Yeah. And it's the result of 12,000 hours of required federal inspections that Pilgrim had to undergo last year.
And the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station still remains in one of the most concerning tiers when it comes to safety.
That's right. It's one of the three worst performing nuclear power plants in the country. It's in column four, which is one step above kind of the worst category.
Mandatory shutdown
in column five. But even with that, the inspectors at a public meeting said that even though the plant's performance was poor, it's not poor enough to shut down at this point.
Still, the plan is to voluntarily shut down the plant in 2019, and I think that's a decision based on economics.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Let's move on. We have some overdose data coming out of the state, and it talks about Barnstable County and where Barnstable County stands in terms of comparison to other counties when it comes to overdoses. Doesn't look like overdoses are slowing down, and actually with fentanyl now, it seems like they're increasing.
Yeah. So state data shows that Barnstable County continues to have the third highest overdose rate in the entire state. And this was data from last year. It's been in the top four since 2013, and it's up there with Bristol, Plymouth, Essex, Berkshire, Suffolk, and Suffolk counties as having the highest overdose rates.
I think anecdotally people can think of Cape Cod largely because of the excellent reporting that's gone on about the problem here for years. I think the media here was kind of ahead of the media in the rest of the state when it came to reporting on the crisis, but also because of the HBO documentary about the opiate problem on Cape Cod. I think people think that Barnstable County is the worst, but really this shows that's not the case. It's a problem across the entire state.
That's right. And I came prior to being on the Cape. I was in Western Mass in Hampshire County, and I know even there, which they have one of the lowest overdose rates, people still felt it strongly. So I think that you really do feel this in all corners of the state when you see your friends and neighbors suffering from addiction and overdosing.
Right. And we're such a small area. We're really, you know, self-contained. So we certainly feel it, as you were saying, when it happens in a neighborhood, as it's much, much too common. Anything else about that report that we should know about in terms of numbers?
Yeah. So overdoses compared to last year were up about 15% across the state. Brian Robbins from the Peer Recovery Center in Hyannis, he says that he expects that rise to continue next year, although the state might be a little more hopeful. They say the rise is slowing, and they noted that the largest increase was between 2013 and 2014, where there was a 40% increase in overdoses.
Yeah, and I was reading this some reporting on this, and again, it's a lot of this has to do with fentanyl.
Absolutely. Yeah. Last year, 77.5% of overdose victims were found to have fentanyl in their systems in Massachusetts.
My goodness. Just when you think you might be making some headway with education and getting the word out there, this fentanyl hits, and it seems to be making it just as bad. Worse.
Right. Just the strength of it really, requires more Narcan, the drug that reverses opiate overdoses, requires more than your typical heroin overdose or other opiate overdose would require.
Okay. Really interesting story about this rest stop that everyone is really familiar with on Route 6. This is the rest stop where the state troopers are always waiting to give people tickets, not to give too many heads up, but that is always the case. Everyone, every Cape Codder, or people who live here and not yet considered Cape Codders, know, slow down there. But now they're talking about not funding this rest stop. It may not even open.
Yeah, so this has to do with the way that the funds from those Cape and Islands license plates that everyone's probably pretty familiar with, how those funds are distributed. So previously, some of the funds from those license plate fees had been kind of funneled through the Barnstable County Commission, and then the commission would issue grants to various economic development opportunities, one of which was the bathrooms, interestingly enough. But this year, they changed the way that they distribute the funds. So now the commission's policy is that the license plate funds won't be allocated directly from the county's operating budget, but it's going to be distributed through a series of grants. And that's put the funding for these bathrooms on the line.
What are people saying about this? That rest stop is well situated for folks who are traveling out to the Outer Cape. And it seems to be very popular. What are people saying about this?
Yeah, so there's kind of two schools of thought here, one of which people are kind of questioning the value of spending money that's meant for economic development on bathrooms, not something that many people think of as something that can spur economic development. And they question whether these visitor centers, which the Yarmouth Chamber of Commerce operates at this rest stop, whether they really have a place today where you can go on your phone and kind of check out the best of an area before you even get there.
That makes sense, because I can remember stopping and looking at the map and finding all the pamphlets of the places you might want to go. I'm sure there's some charm to that remains, but it's an interesting argument.
Yeah, and the Yarmouth Chamber of Commerce, they really do see this as something that can spur economic development. And they note that the Route 6 rest area generates at least 10 seasonal jobs. And last year it served 40,000 guests.
40,000 guests stopped there.
A lot of people stopped there for sure.
Okay. Let's go to the phone where Sarah Brown is joining us from the Vineyard Gazette. Hello, Sarah.
Good morning. Hi.
Good morning to you. So you've been following the moped issue on Martha's Vineyard. It's been very controversial. Maybe give us the background. Tell us what's new.
Yeah. So it's been, as you mentioned, it's always a controversial topic here, and it's been really in the spotlight for the last, I guess since about last July when there was a pretty bad moped accident here on the island, and a young woman lost part of her legs, and there's been a formal complaint filed with Oak Bluff Selectmen about whether they're enforcing moped rental bylaws. And so this really has kind of led to a lot of scrutiny about whether the rental companies are complying with bylaws. And that kind of came to a head this week with the three moped rental companies there, which is three out of four on the island. So most of the mopeds are rented in Oak Bluff. And they came before the selectmen this week to ask for a license renewal. And this included a waiver of the town bylaw that requires an on-site training track, so a place where people kind of do a training run and practice on the mopeds. And that is required under the bylaw. they have not, the rental companies have not been complying with that because, as their representative said this week, they just don't have any place on their property to do that. They've never been granted waivers, which is part of the bylaw says they can be granted a waiver from that provision, but they still have been issued licenses. And this week they came for their license renewal, and an attorney for them said, you know, there's no locations nearby or on their properties to have this training area. They did an exhaustive search, she said. So they proposed kind of a detailed alternative program, which includes ultimately the people who rent mopeds kind of doing a training run on town streets, so kind of a loop there that I think has been done in the past. But Fluckman this time said, no, this doesn't suffice for them. I was at the meeting, and they weighed in, you know, pretty strongly saying that they're not inclined to grant this waiver, that public safety was at issue. One of the selectmen, Kathy Burton, said, you know, she didn't know there was a reason to question the licenses, and now that she knows that there's not a training track waiver in place and that they haven't been doing this, she can't go forward without that requirement being met. So they didn't vote to say no to the licenses. They voted unanimously against waiving this training track requirement, which, of course, is necessary for the companies to have a license. So they do not currently have licenses, with, you know, summer right around the corner. And, you know, as town council was there, and he said the moped rental companies come up with an alternative proposal, they can come back before selectmen, but they said no to this one.
So right now, to be clear, it looks like there will be no moped rentals in Oak Bluffs?
Yeah, as of now, and, you know, summer certainly is right around the corner, so that's kind of hard to see what can happen, you know, in the next few weeks or the next month or two. And who knows, you know, as town council said, perhaps there could be something, an alternate proposed in, you know, 2 weeks that maybe would pass with the selectmen and then they could open. So it's kind of hard to predict what could happen. But as of now, no, there are no moped rental companies in town that have licenses.
Okay, and let's talk about Tisbury's decision on hard alcohol in that town.
Yeah. So Tisbury voters, you know, they went to the polls this week for their town election, and they had a pretty controversial, you know, hotly contested ballot question about whether to allow the sale of hard alcohol in restaurants, along with beer and wine, which was added to town several years ago. And the vote came down in favor of expanding the menu and allowing hard alcohol. I think it was 769 in favor and 475 opposed. So this caps off a pretty long process to allow this, a vote at town meeting, an act of legislature, and this was kind of the final step, was this town election vote. And it was, you know, those opposed kind of said that the town voted in favor of beer and wine, and they said that would be it. And they're now, if they wouldn't ask for hard alcohol, there's concern about package stores and bars down the line, the character of town. But businesses and others said, you know, no big deal to allow people to have a martini with dinner, and also a boost for restaurants because people might want to have a martini or a gin and tonic with dinner and might go to the other towns that allow that. So certainly I think a lot of restaurant owners were happy with this vote. And so the next step is, you know, the town looking at potentially amending their regulations, maybe a public hearing. It's not clear if they'll amend current licenses or if people have to reapply. So they'll deal with that at the administrative town level. But it looks like, I think this summer, people should be allowed to have a cocktail with dinner in Tisbury.
Okay. Cheers to that. Sarah Brown,
yeah,
of the Vineyard Gazette.
Thanks.
Thank you. And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. And welcome back to the Local News Roundup on WCAI. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran. With me in the Woods Hole studio is Chris Lindahl from the Cape Cod Times. George Brennan is here from the Martha's Vineyard Times. On the phone, joining us from the Cape Cod Chronicle newsroom, is Tim Wood. He's the editor there. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Sean.
Tell us what happened at Chatham Town Meeting, Tim.
Okay, well, Chatham actually managed to finish its 40-article annual town meeting warrant in just under 3 hours Monday night.
My goodness.
Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah. Voters blew through more than $40 million in operating, school, capital, and other budgets, basically with no discussion whatsoever. But where the comments did come was, ironically, where the one article that where the town stand to gain some revenue. Voters spent about an hour debating an agreement with Harwich, under which that town will pay Chatham $6.9 million to treat sewage from East Harwich at Chatham's wastewater treatment plant. Now, this plan has been under discussion and negotiation for quite some time now, but opponents at the town meeting said that basically Chatham was not charging enough for the service that they're going to do for Harwich, since this is going to save Harwich millions of dollars by not having to build its own treatment plant. They also claim that there weren't enough safeguards to protect Chatham in the agreement from liability and other things, and that it locked the town into a 50-year a period during which the Harwich sewage could really push the plant over its capacity. That was their claim. Now, supporters said the agreement really only had a duration of 25 years with a possibility of extending it another 25 years. But more important, along with the $6.9 million in revenue that Chatham will get from the agreement, Harwich is going to pay a third of the plant's operating costs. And both communities will benefit because by sewering East Harwich, the nitrogen loading in Pleasant Bay with both towns' share will be reduced or possibly eliminated. So in the end, the voters chose clean water over more revenue, and they approved the agreement 220-61. Now, Harwich Town Meeting approved the agreement last week, but the funding from Harwich is contingent on passage of a debt exclusion override that's coming up this Tuesday at Harwich's annual town election.
And there was a town election, I believe, yesterday in Chatham.
Indeed, there was, and Chatham now has a new selectman. There was only one race on the ballot, and Shireen Davis defeated incumbent Seth Taylor, 1,289-706. This was really a battle between two Chatham natives who are both pretty well known around here. And although she is new to political office, Shireen Davis is well known in town. She's a photographer and artist, and she's been active for many years in fisheries issues. Her family runs one of the last weir fishing operations in Nantucket Sound. The campaign was a bit unusual in that it had something of a messy finish, with Taylor's campaign launched sort of a last-minute drive to brand Davis as an advocate of retail marijuana sales in town after she made a comment at a candidates forum a few weeks ago, in which she said that the issue should not be dismissed outright and that, you know, the town should discuss it. Her comments. Sorry, go ahead.
I think your phone's breaking up on us, Tim. Maybe we could. I think we're going to have to conclude a little bit.
Okay, sure. The bottom line is that this sort of last-minute campaign against Shireen Davis really didn't work, and she was able to pull off a pretty handy victory over incumbent Seth Taylor.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, thank you very much, Tim.
Okay, thanks, Sean.
You're welcome. Chris Lindahl from the Cape Cod Times is here as well. Chris, let's talk about this controversy in Falmouth, where there have been students from the high school, particularly the graduating class, who have been pushing an effort to relocate their graduation ceremony.
Yeah, and it looks like that effort did not work after the school committee discussed the matter last week. Or this week, excuse me.
Yeah, this week. So why did they want to relocate it?
So seniors say that Gov Fuller Field gives them some great memories, some of the best times in their high school career. That's the field where the football team had their undefeated season last fall before going on to win the Division IIA state championship. And then just weeks after that, of course, the two football players Owen Higgins and James Lavin died in a car crash after hockey practice. Now, although the seniors say that their aim wasn't to memorialize Lavin and Higgins, they of course were football players.
Right, I think some people did see it as a tribute to the students. But anyway, this ended up being in the hands of the administration, which said, no, logistically, this is not going to work. And they also talked about perhaps it's not the best thing psychologically for the class.
Right. So the superintendent had met with some members of the senior class to kind of discuss their request. And they thought that the matter was settled after that meeting, where the superintendent said that, no, they'll keep it at the high school field house as it has been for years. And it wasn't until a local lawyer, Laura Monahan, asked the school committee to weigh in on the matter. And that's what led to a 2-hour, pretty emotional discussion this week.
So,
George Brennan, you were there. You were there as a parent.
Yes.
So we need to disclose that.
Yes.
You might have a stake in this somewhere.
Right. Well, my daughter is a graduating senior from Falmouth High School. And I will just say it was a very emotional meeting. 2.5 hours of discussion. And looking across the room, the kids were standing there they were crying. And, there's a lot of talk about re-traumatizing the kids, and there was someone there that night who spoke. She's a grief counselor, and she kind of dismissed that idea. These kids are facing trauma every step of the way. They go to school every day and they see two empty chairs, and
sure. Yeah.
So those issues are there anyway, and it's going to be there whether it's in the field house or on the football field.
In terms of process, what happened here was the school committee decided this is really not our purview. This is an administrative decision. We're not going to take a public stance on this.
Right.
Is that what it boiled down to?
They had said that at the beginning, and they actually did end up taking a vote to support the superintendent. It turned out to be 6-1. Hmm. But I think that may have added a bit of closure. You know, I think if the school committee had left it hanging, the kids might still have some hope of overturning this. But at the end, the school committee chairman, as the Times reported, said, let's try to move on from here and make this the best graduation we can possibly make.
Yeah, a little lesson in government for the graduating class.
Absolutely. And many of them will be voting next Tuesday, I think it is.
For the first time.
So
okay.
Getting the kids engaged.
Let's go to Jim DeRuda on the phone from the New Bedford Standard Times. Hello, Jim.
Morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. So there's this longstanding kind of competition between New Bedford and Fall River. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but that's my understanding. And
So far, so good.
So yeah. Far, so good. Now, and that extends to the two chambers of commerce?
Yeah, there's the New Bedford Area Chamber of Commerce that, spread is in Wareham all the way west into Fall River and past Fall River, plus it heads up north, Freetown, Lakeville. Fall River has formerly had the Fall River Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and they're spread out wide, too. Both chambers share members and all that kind of stuff. And about 10 years ago, they tried to put them together, and that failed miserably. And so now they've been working together. They do legislative luncheons and breakfasts together, and they lobby together, and they do work together. The two presidents are collegial and effective.
Okay.
But in the fall, there was the New Bedford Chamber had a kind of visioning retreat, and one of the spitball ideas that came out of it was, how about if we changed our name to South Coast Chamber of Commerce? And somehow that leaked out of that meeting, got over to the Fall River Chamber, and they weren't happy with that, and it started a little tiff. Well, Fall River's first response was to change its name to Bristol County Chamber of Commerce. That's a recent change.
Okay.
But yesterday, a joint press release came out saying that the two chambers are going to work together, and they're going to create a larger group, a South Coast collective, but they also intend to, not that they're going to join under one umbrella, but
right.
They're going to try to work together for, some of the broader purposes that they hadn't been touching on yet. And they hope to reach out to Cranberry Country and Canal and Cape Cod Chambers and farther north. They hope eventually to create a consortium, a coalition of chambers that they hope would be one of the more powerful ones in New England.
Okay. Well, a nice ending to the story.
Indeed. I think they did a really great job of working through some of the goofy things like a leak here and a leak there or something, and goodwill and competent actors, I think, produced a really good outcome.
All right, Jim DeRuda, the editorial page editor of the New Bedford Standard Times. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Sean.
Okay, Chris Lindahl is here from the Cape Cod Times. Chris, let's talk about Climate House. I wasn't familiar with this house, but apparently it's right here in Woods Hole. Now, this is a building where they house scientists, right, for the institution?
That's right. And the heart of the dispute here is whether this house, which operates seasonally to host guests and researchers at the various scientific institutions at Woods Hole, whether this house is primarily an educational institution or a lodging house, because those two uses would be treated differently under town zoning laws. So this was bought in 2013 by the Climate Foundation, which is a nonprofit that works on sustainable solutions related to climate change. And they're currently involved in a dispute with the town.
About what you were saying, about the zoning and whether this designation, are you really educating people there? Are you just housing people there?
Right. And so the organization kind of views this place as a scientific salon of sorts where scientists can gather and come up with solutions for climate change. And it's really not just a place to stay. But the town and some neighbors, they disagree with that, and they really do see it as more of a short-term lodging house. And they pointed to the fact that it was listed on Airbnb at one point for a short-term stay.
So this was driven primarily by neighbors who were upset about the comings and goings and the activity in the building, and that led to some questions about whether they were complying with local zoning laws.
That's right. They noticed the noise and the kind of increased activities that the shorter-term tenants brought to the neighborhood.
This goes to the courts now?
First, the land court has appointed a retired judge to act as a neutral mediator with the hope that the town and the organization might be able to settle this outside of court.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on that story. Let's go to the phone. Ed Miller joining us from the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Ed.
Hello, Sean.
Very interesting story about a woman named Nancy Swanson, and she had been dishonorably discharged from the U.S. Army, 51 years ago?
Yes, it was back in the 1960s. She was a young woman in her 20s, and she was kicked out of the U.S. Army because of her sexual orientation. And more than 50 years later, she has received notice from the Army that it has reversed its ruling, and she has been restored to her full rank, which was Specialist E4, and her discharge has been changed from dishonorable to honorable. But during those more than 50 years, she really suffered greatly. And it's quite a remarkable story, really, because she was someone who loved the Army. She signed up right after graduating from high school in Ashland, Mass. Mm-hmm. Talked her way in, basically. She was 5 feet tall, weighed less than 100 pounds, and barely met the physical requirements. But she wanted to join the Army to serve her country, she says, and to find out who she was. And after basic training, she was assigned to a cryptography team where she decoded and relayed messages from Army headquarters to stations all over the Pacific. And she loved it. But then one day, she was dragged before the U.S. Army's Criminal Investigation Division, the CID, known by gay and lesbian soldiers at the time as Uncle Sid. And she wasn't even told what offense she was charged with, but she had to take a lie detector test and was questioned for hours and then was basically kicked out with no benefit.
Ed, let me ask you, did she have anything to do with this being overturned? Did she petition for this in any way, or is this something that's happening across the country to people who are humiliated like this?
She did have something to do with it. For many years, she suffered basically in silence from shame and anxiety, and finally was diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. She got help from medical professionals, and her therapist basically told her that she needed to do something to get this ruling changed. She went to the local Council on Aging here in Provincetown, where volunteers helped her with research and filling out the application. And now her life has dramatically changed. She says that there are things I've held in for 50 years. She says there are stories I still can't talk about. How many other people went through this and never said anything? I want them to know they can get the record changed.
Powerful story in the Provincetown Banner. I hope encourage people to go read that. Let's move on to the Herring River Restoration Project. This is a major, major project out in the Outer Cape. And there was some concerns that this restoration project would affect a local golf course, country club. So what's going on there?
Absolutely. This is really a stunning development in the long continuing saga of the Herring River restoration, which has been planned for more than 10 years now. The estuary of the Herring River covers about 1,100 acres, and one section of it is basically the Chequesset Yacht and Country Club in Wellfleet, one of two nine-hole golf courses on the Outer Cape, the other one in Truro, Highland Links. But it's a very nice little course, but it's very low-lying, being basically in the Mill Creek sub-basin of the estuary. And even now, several of the fairways are often more or less underwater at in wet weather. The restoration of the river many people thought would really put the golf course out of business. And what has happened is that the Herring River Restoration Committee has come to an agreement with the country club to rebuild the golf course for up to $5 million. They're estimating that the cost of raising the fairways, et cetera, will be about $3.3 million. And then they're also setting aside $1.7 million to reimburse the country club for estimated operating losses while the course is closed. So this is still just a proposal. They've come to an agreement about it. The restoration project still has to raise the money. The total cost of the project is thought to be between $40 and $50 million. So it's a big deal.
It is a big deal. Ed Miller, the Provincetown Banner, thanks for filling us in.
You're welcome. Thanks, John.
You're welcome. Let's take a quick break. Chris Lindahl is here from the Cape Cod Times. George Brennan is here from the Martha's Vineyard Times. And we'll speak with George when we get back. Welcome back to the local news roundup here on The Point on WCAI. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran. We're rounding up the top local stories of the week. Chris Lindahl is here from the Cape Cod Times. George Brennan is in the studio as well from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, let's talk about the coverage of a Cape and Islands assistant district attorney who is in front of the Board of Bar Overseers. Now, they're the group that disciplines attorneys when they do something that's wrong. And, of course, they're trying to determine what happened here.
Right. This is Laura Marshard, and she is the assistant district attorney assigned to Edgartown, the district court there. And this all centers around a dispute over whether she turned over information she should have turned over to defense attorneys. The defense attorneys say she should have, that it was exculpatory evidence that would have helped their clients get off. And she says that, it was not intentional. She hasn't actually testified yet. The interesting thing about this is we're into day five on this.
I know. It seems to be dragging on and on.
Yes.
It's like a real trial.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's going to be continued now into June. The next date is June 7th. So they're taking a break from it. But they still haven't gotten to some key witnesses like Michael O'Keefe. Is possibly going to be called as a witness.
District attorney in Barnstable County.
Right. And the clerk magistrate on the island, Williamson, is expected to be called in this as well.
What drove this? Was this a defense attorney who brought this about, or was this a judge?
Well, initially it was a judge. During a case, he actually stopped the proceedings at one point and called out the assistant district attorney for, being win-at-all-cost type of an attorney. I think he directed that at the defense attorneys as well.
Wow.
It was sort of like, he was seeing this back and forth, and they were both obviously, in any case, they're trying to win, right? But in this case, he kind of felt as if they were overstepping it. We don't know exactly who brought this complaint.
And the Board of Bar Overseers didn't have to take the complaint
right.
Anyway. What type of sanctions are on the table here if she is found to have actually done something wrong?
It could be anywhere from, an admonishment to, having her license suspended for a period of time to, I would imagine, revocation. She is launching a spirited defense. Mm-hmm. She's got a high-profile attorney, Beth Mulvey. And she, from what our reporter says, is really going after these two defense attorneys. And she's trying to paint the picture that, the island isn't what these panelists might have envisioned in their mind from a visit to the island during the tourist season. This is a tight-knit group, sort of a club-type atmosphere at the court. Where everybody has everybody else's back, and she walked into that hornet's nest.
And we should note that Machard is being supported by the Barnstable County District Attorney, who I understand has been attending those hearings.
That's correct.
Okay. Let's talk about the Aquinnah tribe. There's been lots of consternation on the island, on Martha's Vineyard, for years about the possibility that the Aquinnah tribe could open some sort of casino there. Now it's actually looking more likely, not a full casino, we're talking a bingo slots type parlor. Is that accurate? I'm always trying to get a sense of what that means because I've never actually seen that.
Okay. So, this story has as many twists and turns as the road to Aquinnah has from the ferry. It's amazing the amount of twists and turns. But just to answer your question about what a bingo hall is, so under federal Indian gaming, if a state has legalized gaming, and in this case Massachusetts does, a tribe is entitled to do whatever gaming if they're federally recognized. And so they're looking to open a class two, which is bingo. And bingo slots are very similar. Walking in there, you would have no idea that it's different than any other kind of slot machine.
Okay.
But it's tied to other slot machines, much like bingo is tied to other players, where you're playing bingo against other players.
Ah, I see.
That's what it is. But they have the look and feel of a regular slot machine. And the tribe in Florida, help me out, anybody?
Is it the Seminole?
Yeah, the Seminole tribe, thank you. They made billions. I mean, they own Hard Rock worldwide now on bingo slot machines. So
okay. If
that gives you any indication that you can make some money from them. Now, where it is located on the island, it's going to be a lot tougher, gaming experts say, for the Aquinnah tribe to make much money there because, there's no major infrastructure in and out. So it's going to be a difficult road. The Aquinnah has done their own sort of assessment on this and has reported in court filings that they believe they can make up to $4.5 million a year.
Oh, my.
Out of that hall.
And so the recent news that seems to affirm that this could possibly, they're on the road to a bingo slots hall, so what was this? There was an appeal?
So there was an appeal of, the appeals court had supported the tribe, and the state, the town, and this community taxpayers group appealed that to the First Circuit. They wanted them to rehear the case. This week, a ruling came down that said, we're not going to rehear the case. The judges have voted, and they're not going to rehear it. That means the next step is the Supreme Court for this case. Both the town and the taxpayers group have already weighed in and said, we're going to petition to have this heard by the Supreme Court. The state has not yet said whether they'll join in on that. And just for perspective, the Supreme Court gets thousands of cases every year they're asked to do. They only take 1% of the cases. So it's a really steep hill to climb for the town and the taxpayers group.
It was interesting when Deval Patrick and his administration were looking to promote casino gambling in Massachusetts. They spoke a lot with the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe and really worked with them to develop a plan. But Aquinnah was kind of left out in the cold. I guess the thinking was, well, they signed an agreement years ago that they wouldn't open a gaming parlor. We're not going to reopen that. But thinking back, maybe it would have been good for the Deval Patrick administration to actually work with the Aquinnah as well.
You know, the Aquinnah wanted that.
Yeah.
They actually sent a letter to the governor. They had a purchase and sales agreement on property in Freetown, Lakeville.
Right.
They didn't want to do this on the island. They live there. They understand, you know,
fragility.
That part of the island is very fragile. There's not a lot of infrastructure there. They didn't want it there. They wanted to talk to Patrick, and the Patrick administration was very firm. They never wavered.
Right.
You got to give them credit for that. And then, so once seeing that, the tribe went ahead. They got federal approval. They have federal approval in hand for that bingo hall. And that's when Deval Patrick filed suit against them. He filed suit in state court for a breach of contract. The tribe was able to have that move to federal court saying, this is a federal issue, whether we have Indian gaming rights or not. It's a federal law. So that's where we are now, and we're waiting for the next twists and turns on this.
Okay, George Brennan, the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you, George, for that update. Chris Lindahl from the Cape Cod Times. Voters back the Dennis Yarmouth school budget. Now, the school budget for Dennis Yarmouth, always very controversial, but seems to have passed.
Yeah, and this time is certainly not an exception to that. So they did pass the $570,000 Proposition 2.5 override.
These are Yarmouth, right?
This is Yarmouth, mm-hmm. Yes. But there was a lot of discussion about whether the amount that Yarmouth is expected to pay in the DY budget is fair. So a few years ago, they switched from a kind of a formula that the two towns worked out themselves to a state-recommended formula. And school committee chairman Brian Carey pointed out that if the district was still using that previous formula, Yarmouth would actually owe $1.1 million less than it currently does.
Okay, well, maybe so they're going to revisit the formula perhaps, or is that was bandied around at least?
Yeah, there is talk about looking at the formula and certainly looking at how the school district is funded, but I heard some criticism at town meeting that town officials had kind of been dragging their feet on this, and this is something that they really should have addressed several years ago.
And of course, Dennis would have to be willing to address that as well.
That's right, and that's kind of always the complication in regional school districts is that you have to kind of corral two or more towns together to really agree on something. And when it comes to money, it's not exactly an easy thing to agree on.
That's a good point. Orleans, voters there approved a new budget, new DPW facility.
That's right. But there, again, concerns about whether the town is doing the best to manage its finances. They approved two overrides, one of which was for the construction of a new public works and natural resources building. That was $13.57 million. That's going to be paid over a 30-year period. And another $3.6 million override for wastewater and water quality planning and improvements. Now, the Finance Committee, they've raised some concerns that the town has this history of maintaining a low property tax rate kind of by pushing projects down the road. And they say that strategy puts the town at financial risk, and it's something that really needs to be addressed by better fiscal planning.
Okay. Sad story. A driver's pull Eastham man out of a pond. And this was a boater who was underwater for quite some time.
Yeah, the man he hasn't been identified, but he was underwater for over an hour before being pulled out. Now, this is in Great Pond. They had a dive team out there on Tuesday to complete the rescue. And when they pulled him out, he was in 12 to 15 feet of water and a foot or two of silt. Really, really kind of murky conditions in that pond, which made the rescue difficult for first responders. So after they pulled him out, they performed CPR on the way to the hospital. And he was taken to the hospital.
Was he doing some repairs? Do we know what was going on? How he found himself under the boat?
Yeah, the man was boating in the pond, and apparently he had some difficulty with the boat before requiring the rescue.
Oh, I see. Dennis, voters approve recreational marijuana retail ban. That's a popular topic these days around the state, banning the potential arrival of recreational marijuana businesses. And what do we need to know there?
Yeah, so Dennis is now the second town so far that's banned the sale of recreational retail marijuana. That it's important to note this is distinct from medical marijuana. So at this point on Cape Cod, at least, recreational marijuana sales will not be allowed in Dennis or Sandwich, which also passed a ban a couple weeks ago. And Falmouth is also considering a ban. Kind of as a counter, you have P-Town. Provincetown was the second most supportive town in the entire state when it came to voting in favor of recreational marijuana in November. And their town meeting last month, they passed a 2% optional 2% tax that will go directly into their budget when eventually the idea is that recreational marijuana shops will be opened in Provincetown.
Okay. Let's talk about sharks, because everyone loves to talk about sharks on Cape Cod. I think we might have had our first sighting of a great white shark of the season. But officials are looking at how to keep people safe. Is there technology out there that can help identify sharks and let people know what's going on? What's happening with that? I understand it's an expensive endeavor.
Yeah, really. The bottom line is that it's very expensive keeping an eye on sharks and keeping swimmers and beachgoers safe. So the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, they've commissioned developers to create their Sharktivity app. And that provides over 100,000 people with alerts on their phone, kind of like a weather alert or a news alert. But in this case, it's to alert people that there's a shark nearby based on the tagged sharks that inhabit the waters around Cape Cod. So that cost $20,000, and they were able to pull that off by two major donors, Amelia Rose Jewelry and Everglade Boats. But when it comes to Wellfleet, which is Wellfleet or other towns that are looking to use some technology, they're kind of on their own.
Right. They don't have a nonprofit to fundraise for them.
Right. So the Miami-based Altimetry, they use weather balloons with some pretty high-tech cameras to keep an eye on sharks in the water. Mm. They say it's going to cost $300,000 for a 12-week program where contractors would fly these balloons around the beach and analyze the video to see where sharks are swimming and track them.
Hmm. Okay, and I think we'd seen a story before about potentially drones. So there's a lot of discussion about how to keep an eye on the sharks.
Yeah, a lot of discussion about how to keep an eye on sharks and what the best way and possibly the cheapest way to do that while still maintaining the safety of swimmers.
George Brennan?
You know, we're lucky that our waters here are fairly cold, because I was watching some footage this morning on one of the morning news shows, and they had footage of 15 great whites around someone out on a paddleboard, and there was a plane over it or a helicopter over it, and they were saying, "Beware, there are sharks in the water," and
wow.
This person was on a paddleboard.
Craziness.
Pretty terrifying.
Pretty terrifying. Okay, well, that's the local news roundup here on The Point. I want to thank Chris Lindahl from the Cape Cod Times. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Sean.
And George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times.
Thanks, Sean.
Came into the studio. Sarah Brown, we spoke to on the phone from the Vineyard Gazette. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Jim DeRuda of the New Bedford Standard Times. And Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner all filled us in on what's been happening this week. I'm Sean Corcoran. Thanks for listening.
The Friday News Roundup is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.